Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 50 years ago this week, America crowded around TV sets watching Neil Armstrong take man's first step onto the moon. And that included a kid from East Detroit named Jerry Leninger. That moonwalk inspired him to become an astronaut with missions aboard two U.S. space shuttles, as well as the Russian space station Mir, traveling some 54 million miles in space. Today, he's retired in northern Michigan. Jerry Leninger, good to talk with you again. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia. Good to be back with you.
Well, here we are saying, how did this happen? 50 years, the anniversary of Apollo 11. Jerry, take us back to July 1969. And what do you most remember about watching Neil Armstrong take that first step onto the lunar surface?
You know, I was a 14-year-old kid. I was on a camping trip up in Canada looking up at the moon. And I said, you know, our guys are up there. I told my brother Ken, our guys are up there. That's incredible. And we made our way back to the general campground, and someone had an old-fashioned generator and a black-and-white TV sitting on the picnic table, and every camper in the area was gathered around that. And I can remember Walter Cronkite, you know, choking up with a tear in his eye, saying, man on the moon, and then he ripped his glasses off and, you know, wiped a tear from his eye. And I said, man, we are doing something fabulous here. The whole world is watching. Walter Cronkite is crying. I want to do that someday. And so that inspired the living daylights out of me. Went home, blue collar neighborhood, Detroit. Dad drove a telephone truck, five kids in the family. And I said, Dad, I want to be an astronaut someday. And he said, Jerry, this is America. You work hard, study hard, be anything you set your mind to.
And you did.
Yeah. And that, you know, so that moment inspired me, as I'm sure it's inspired many people. And even now, 50 years, you know, later, it still inspires us. We still, when something's difficult, we say, hey, we landed a man on the moon. We can do that. And so I think that there's those intangibles it gives you besides the tangibles.
And I know you joined the Navy, you went to medical school at Wayne State, and then in August 1992, you became a member of Astronaut Selection Group 14 and launched into space your first time September 9th, 1994, aboard the Space Shuttle Discovery. What is it
Yahoo!
Like?
Yahoo!
Tell us what
Yahoo,
that's like.
Yahoo! 14 years old, and then I'm launching to space. So the dream realized. And half of Michigan was at that launch because it was a January launch. So they all went to Florida and were poolside while I was out on that rocket. And, you know, what a thrill. It's just, you know, raw power, incredible power, about 7 million pounds of thrust. And to put that in perspective, the Apollo rockets were closer to 8 million pounds of thrust. And to put that into today's perspective, you know, the Falcon Heavy, the big rocket that we talk about now, the biggest rocket out there, is about 5 million pounds of thrust. So 8 million for the Apollo, 5 million for the one we have now. It tells you, you know, that was a heck of an accomplishment back in, you know, using 1960s technology. We had the Saturn V rocket, which had five engines, essentially, for the primary stage, where now we have to strap together 27 rocket engines to try to, you know, get even close to that much power. So, you know, it's incredible what they did back then.
And for you, as one of a handful, I mean, fewer than 600 of you can, you know, in human history can say, we went into space. Is there any sense of, what did I get myself into and I'm afraid, or was it Yahoo?
It was Yahoo. On the other hand, during the launch, you are just focused, concentrating, making sure you're not letting your teammates down. And in my case, I was telling myself, I'm not letting my organization down, United States Navy, going to represent them well. And also kind of more broadly saying, I'm representing mankind. So during the actual, you know, 7 minutes to get to orbit of utter chaos and acceleration and fireball and, you know, everything else, sound wave just beating through you like a bass drum. You are just focused, you know, doing your job, making sure you're not, you know, moving the wrong switch at the wrong time. And then after the engines cut off, I actually had a job right away to float into the window and take a photo of the external tank before it moved too far away. But after I did that, then I finally, you know, caught my breath. And then sort of an instant replay in my mind of the actual thrill of it all and the, you know, felt the whole thing. And that's when my heart raced, and that's when my pulse shot up, and I, you know, started sweating and started just screaming Yahoo. but during the phase, you couldn't afford to do that, so you compartmentalize that video sort of in your mind, and then immediate replay it. And I saw the same in all my crewmates, and we're just, you know, hugging each other and everybody's screaming. And yeah, we're in space.
And you look back and you see Earth from space. What's your memory of that first view?
You know, it's just awesome. You're looking at the planet as a whole. You feel, you know, it makes you feel big, because you're like this godlike view of creation. And then on the other hand, I'd be on the dark side of the earth sometimes, looking out into the universe and seeing, you know, literally thousands and thousands of stars, and knowing that there's billions and even trillions of them out there, even trillions of galaxies. And it makes you feel so small. And so you've got the extremes, you know, making you feel big and making you feel like a dot in the universe simultaneously almost. So it's a profound, life-changing experience, at least for me, when I ventured out into space.
And then you ventured out again, only in a different way. You trained to be a cosmonaut. You learned Russian, and you were on board the Russian space station Mir. You think of this intense race to the moon between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and there you are, aboard Mir. It was a real new chapter in space history, wasn't it?
Da, konnichiwa.
Yeah,
myself and two Russians. They speak no English. You're pretty much controlled by Mission Control Moscow. It was, I would say, if God were looking down on us, he wouldn't know which one was the American. So I was there to learn the Russian ways, to learn how they had, you know, accomplished the things they did in long-duration space flight, and to get us ready to build the International Space Station. So I guess a bit of a guinea pig, if you will, and just kind of threw me out there. 2 years in Russia, learning the language, 5 months in space. And that's a whole different experience than the much more compact shuttle flight where everything's kind of mapped out. Here, you're just trying to stay on an even keel, try to get 120 different experiments done. Had a failing space station, so trying to keep that space station alive, design life 3 to 5 years, and it was about 13 years old. Mm. So you learned a lot from that. And it reminds me, you know, even back in the Apollo days with the Apollo 1 fire, we lose three of our astronauts, Grissom, Chafee, and White. Chafee and White, I think, have ties to the University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. But after that, you know, we designed new materials, and now firefighters today use those materials.
And you certainly tested them, because you had the most severe fire ever aboard an orbiting spacecraft, and you survived it.
That's true. And that's a scary moment, trust me. You're up there cut off, isolated, and you've got flames 3 or 4 feet in length, blowtorch-like in intensity, sparks flying, and you realize that hull is paper thin, you know, made out of aluminum. And you know if that blowtorch points down, it's going to pierce the hull, rapid decompression, quick suffocation. And so, again, that's where all your professional training, my own case, you know, flying off the aircraft carriers at night, launching in rockets, all those things come to play. And you learn to, just like I was talking about during launch, you learn to compartmentalize the chaos around you and use your brain and work your way through the problem. And we methodically did that, myself, my cosmonaut crewmates, also professionals who knew what they were doing, been in some tight situations. One of them was an old MiG fighter pilot. And so, you know, you keep your cool and you survive. And then again, then you go to a sort of a dark corner of the space station, and then you go through the emotion of it, and you let those emotions out.
I'm speaking with former astronaut Jerry Leninger. This Navy veteran these days is enjoying life on the Leelanau Peninsula, but he flew aboard the space shuttle's Discovery in Atlantis and served nearly 5 months on the Russian space station Mir. I want to just play a quick little round robin here, because you hear these questions all the time, but you are one of a handful of people in history who can tell us what it is like to live in space. So I'm going to toss out a word. Give us your strongest memory or feeling. Weightlessness.
Just freedom, just floating freedom, you know, 100 somersaults in a row and a big smile on your face.
Were you good at being weightless, or did it take a little practice?
Oh, I was excellent at being weightless, but it was probably 30 days into that mission, and I saw the same sort of transformation take place in my two Russian crewmates. And when the shuttle arrived to pick me up, it was kind of like a herd of buffalo coming aboard. And these are experienced astronauts, but they are definitely not space adapted like I was. I was flying as if I, you know, had done that all my life, and I could be upside down talking to you right now, and I'd be totally comfortable. So I was three-dimensional at that point. I didn't see floors, walls, ceiling. I just saw volume. That's another little interesting aspect is that people say, how do you live in a place, you know, cramped like that for 5 months? But it's a little bit bigger because, you know, you can be up on the ceiling, you can be down on the floor, you can be standing on a wall. And so you're seeing volume, and therefore I never felt sort of claustrophobic during the 5 months on a pretty small space station.
Then flipping the coin, getting back to Earth and back to gravity.
Yeah, you're heavy. Feels like you're on my shoulders the whole time. Turn your head too fast. You feel like you're doing backflips, you know, inner ear sort of maladjusted. So it's a bit of a transition to go from spaceman back to earthling. And as a matter of fact, the bone loss I had about 12-14% bone loss, hips, lower spine. And that took me a couple years to get back to about a 2%, looks like permanent bone loss. You know, Cynthia, I just took a little bicycle ride up in the Upper Peninsula. I just took off for 6 days. About 350 miles, and I can remember distinctly that about a year and a half after my flight, I was riding my bicycle, and all of a sudden it kicked back in. Sort of that neuromuscular disconnect that I had suddenly took care of itself, and I felt normal again. So literally a year and a half after my flight, I still didn't feel quite right, and then it was just literally from one revolution to the next on that bicycle, it clicked back in. Started doing 100-mile bike rides, things I'd done in the past. And then at 2 years, I was pretty much feeling back to normal. So it's a tough, you know, transition back to the Earth.
Jerry, as we are here talking to mark the 50th anniversary since the United States won the race to the moon, why does it matter that the United States was first?
You know, it was the Cold War. It was competition. I love competition. I love free enterprise. I love what happens, you know, when our private enterprise companies are up against each other. I love what's happening right now with Elon Musk and SpaceX and NASA. And, you know, we got so many rockets, it's hard to keep track of them. So I love the competition. I think it brings out the best in us. And I think by challenging, like Kennedy did to us, to say we're going to get to the moon in this decade, you know, that brought out the best in all of us. So I think it's important because the United States proved that our system works, that our, you know, our liberty and our freedom, the things that our people have because we live in this great nation, you know, we can excel. And we definitely excelled during that time. Matter of fact, when I hear nowadays when they say we're going back to the moon and people right away jump saying, you know, we need to make this an international cooperation, you just can't do it by yourself. That's sort of the official line, but I'll tell you, I'm not sure I believe that.
Why?
50 years ago, the United States did it alone. You know, it's the United States flag that was on the moon. And so I'm all for cooperation. But my experience working with the Russians, I think I learned a little bit that sometimes it can be a bit of an anchor and you're sort of wasting some resources on some technology that you've already surpassed a long time ago. So I love partnerships, but not the drag of partnerships. And so someone has to contribute or just leave them behind, in my mind. And if you want to go to the moon, it's tough. So,
yeah,
you know, you got to push it. And we're pushing it now. The Artemis program just announced they want to do it by 2024 back to the moon. And that's a challenge. And everybody better be on board. And you cannot be dead weight in a program like that.
I was checking NASA's budget for fiscal year 2020. It was $21 billion, up 1.4% over the previous fiscal year, 2019. Why should we fund NASA when our nation has so many other needs? Why does space exploration by the United States of America matter to that much money?
Yeah, I think with that much money, you got the human part of that is about $3 billion of it, and they want about a $1.5 billion boost. I just say, first of all, put that number in perspective. The bailout during the recession to just one company was over $120 billion. $120 billion, and we're talking a NASA budget that is, you know, doing all kinds of stuff besides the human spaceflight, you know, designing better aircraft, everything else, about $20 billion. So I think the nation can afford it for sure. And I guess the second point, that inspiration I talked about, I think that's important. But probably the most important thing is pushing technology. And people often ask me, you know, should we go to the moon? Should we go to Mars? Should we go to a meteor? You know, what should we go to? Some asteroid out there? It doesn't matter. The important thing is that we do something challenging and hard and so that it brings out the best in us and that so it keeps our technology on the cutting edge and competitive in the global competitive environment that we find ourselves. So, you know, even back to Apollo, there's so many things that happen, miniaturization of computers, miniaturization of cameras, lighter weight materials, materials that could withstand heavy heat. A more mundane example is the launch pad, or that big Saturn V rocket with 8 million pounds of thrust really rocked that structure. And they had some basic shock absorbers along the side of that structure to withstand it so that you didn't, you know, knock the launch pad down. That same design, literally the same design, is used in bridges today. We got the earthquakes out in California, and a lot of those bridges have those shock absorbers built into them to withstand the seismic shock of the earthquakes. And so the spinoffs are incredible. The job creation is incredible. John Young, who drove the rover on the moon, I used to have dinner at his house every Sunday night, and he said, "Jerry, I don't know what people thought. I never took sacks of money and buried them in the lunar soil. Those sacks of money went to a toolmaker in Peoria, Illinois, to some guy building a nut and bolt in Detroit, Michigan. It went and paid engineers, it paid postdocs, it encouraged our universities in engineering, the things that we're trying to encourage now, the STEM fields. You know, that money was well spent. That's the kind of seed money a government should be interested in sowing, you know? That actually is creating jobs. That's actually creating prosperity for our country.
So 50 years after you sat at that campground and watched Neil Armstrong step onto the moon, what advice would you give to a kid in Michigan today harboring dreams of being part of the next wave of space exploration?
You know, study hard, man. Do things you enjoy. Realize there's no limits out there. Again, I'm a, you know, blue-collar neighborhood public school guy. Got to go into space and got to associate with some of the, you know, really elite brain power of the world. And that space program brings together that elite brain power. So, you know, set your goal, have that stretch goal out there, but make sure you have intermediate goals along the way. And if you never make it to that stretch goal because you get interested in something else along the way, it still served you well. It got you out there working hard, accomplishing things, and moving our nation forward. And back to your, you know, basic question about the finances and why is it worth it for NASA, you know, without the prosperity of this country, without people doing those job creations, the Bill Gateses creating a, you know, something like Microsoft and the hundreds of thousands of jobs created and the prosperity created, you know, we don't have the budget to do anything advanced. And it's a privilege to have that. So I guess to any young person, you know, you're in the right place at the right time, and the sky is not the limit. You know, I found out the sky is not the limit. You can go to space, and who knows where we go to next generation.
Jerry Linenger, it is always great talking with you. Thank you so much for being